Welcome back to the Australian Histories Podcast. Today, I thought we might have a quick look at a well-known and, I'm advised, extremely well-loved traditional Australian song, Waltzing Matilda. I hope it's not unpatriotic of me to say that while I enjoy the little ditty to a certain extent, for its jaunty tune and fun language, it has always puzzled me as to why people see it as a sort of pseudo-Australian anthem. It's a bit of a weird one, given it's about a sheep thief killing himself rather than surrendering to police, so it's hardly an uplifting little number. But I recently came across a book by Dennis O'Keefe called Waltzing Matilda, The Secret History of Australia's Favourite Song. So I think there's more to this song than I've been giving it credit for, and it may well deserve the deeper hold it appears to have on the Australian psyche. So here I am, reading O'Keefe's thesis on the song, and we'll see if I feel any more impressed with it at the end of the podcast. I hope you'll enjoy the exploration too, fan or no fan of Waltzing Matilda. Before I begin, I'd like to thank Mark O, Lydia De C, Mark W, and Rebecca C, whose recent contributions to the show were much appreciated. You will have noticed my output has slowed right down these days. Look, I just had to pay more attention to the other things in my life. The research for each podcast is very time-consuming, but I have such a great list of story ideas still to look at that I can't quite bring myself to stop producing the podcast altogether yet. So I'll just keep plodding along at this slow rate, and we'll see how we go. Now for this episode, let's take a closer look at our jolly swagman and his jumbuck pilfering story. Now, many Australians will know the words to Waltzing Matilda, and a good many international listeners may well have heard of it too. I am advised by a number of the sources that Waltzing Matilda is, in fact, one of the most recorded songs in the world. Wow! O'Keefe notes there are over 700 versions collected so far by the Australian National Film and Sound Archive here. It was first recorded more than 30 years after it was written, in 1926 or 27, depending on the source, by John Collinson, a tenor from Queensland. O'Keefe suggests it was Peter Dawson's 1938 recording, played across radios worldwide, that made it an international hit. Soldiers would sing it, with various swing versions played throughout World War II, and international recording artists such as Burl Ives, Chubby Checker, Harry Belafonte, and Johnny Cash were just a few who did their take on the Aussie song. It was even covered by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. In Australia, it was performed for Queen Elizabeth's Royal Tour in 1954 by the South Australian Symphony Orchestra and the Adelaide Singers at the Royal Gala Concert. And folk, country and pop singers from Slim Dusty, the Bushwhackers and the Seekers, through to Kate Sobrano, Jessica Mauboy and Kylie Minogue, have also had a crack. According to Wiki, it's the theme song for Australia in the video game Civilization VI. Who remembers that? It's been called the People's Song, and it's probably much more well-known than our actual national anthem around the world. It's been played at the Olympic and Commonwealth Games, at our AFL and NRL Grand Finals, and O'Keefe reminds us it's also, quote, marched Australians home from several wars, walked Prime Ministers into office, and echoed around every schoolroom, unquote, over time. Still, given the topic, and later, as we'll discuss, the potential history of the song, it still seems to me an odd one, if you actually listen to the words. The swagman, and as it will turn out, petty thief, only seemed jolly for a short time as he settles down at a comfortable camp. When he opportunistically nabs a wandering sheep to keep as food, he's discovered by the sheep's owner and three police. Rather than be taken in and subject to the law, he instead jumps into the water and drowns himself. Good Lord. Surely Peter Allen's I Still Call Australia Home, or Men at Work's eminently danceable I come from a land down under, reflect the cheerier and more romantically sentimental Aussie spirit, but I'm being too harsh. It is a catchy little ditty. Lots of people outside of Australia will know it, or know of it, though I'm guessing if you didn't grow up in Australia hearing it, you might find the language it uses a little puzzling. Indeed, most Australians born post-Second World War may well be struggling a bit with some of the terms used too. Given many of the interesting Australian slang words in the song were not really used much into the 20th century, let alone the 21st, but it's the language that makes this song so interesting in my opinion. While the versions might differ slightly in the words sung, let's have a quick look at the first verse and see if we can work it out. Oh, there once was a swagman camped in a billabong. A swagman is a person who carries a swag. The Australian National Dictionary further describes such a person as, quote, an itinerant worker, especially one in search of employment, who carries a swag. A vagrant, unquote, and notes that the term's appearance into the lexicon occurred in the 1860s. He camps by a billabong, that is, a waterhole. Once again, the Australian National Dictionary defines billabong as, quote, an arm of a river made by water flowing from the main stream, usually only in times of flood, to form a backwater, blind creek, and a branch, or, when the water level falls, a pool or lagoon. Billabongs are often formed when floodwaters recede. The word comes from the southwestern New South Wales Aboriginal language Wiradjuri. Billa, meaning river, and bung, a suffix probably indicating a continuation in time or space, or functioning as an intensifier, the combination signifying a watercourse that runs only after rain, first recorded in the 1830s, unquote. Under the shade of a coolabah tree. Coolabah is another word borrowed from Aboriginal language, probably from the Yuwa Larray and neighbouring languages of northern New South Wales, being a term that describes several eucalypt species. With varied spelling over the years, the dictionary records its first noted use occurring in the 1870s. And he sang as he looked at the old billy boiling. So that's fairly self-explanatory, unless you're not sure what a billy is. So, just in case, quote, a vessel for the boiling of water, making of tea, etc., over an open fire. A cylindrical container, usually of tin, enamelware or aluminium, fitted with a lid and a wire handle. It comes from the Scottish dialect word billy pot, meaning cooking utensil. The term's probably reinforced by the bully beef tin, also used as a container for cooking. It is not, as is popularly thought, related to the Aboriginal word billabong. Billy is first recorded in the 1840s, unquote. Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me? And here the meanings get a little more perplexing. For all its Australianness in the resulting song, it's surprising to think about the origins of the terms waltzing and Matilda. In the Australian idiom, waltzing Matilda means to tramp, to be on the road carrying one's swag, or Matilda, another term used for swag, from place to place, looking for itinerant work or shearing jobs and the like, carrying one swag containing all your personal belongings along with you. But interestingly, the origins of both terms appear to be German. Waltzing comes from the German term Aufwaltz, meaning to go a-wandering. O'Keefe recounted that in Germany, trade apprentices were required to travel for a period of time, gaining wide experience and honing their skills as itinerant tradesmen, working with a range of master craftsmen over a 3-year period. They would carry only their tools and bare necessities in their bedroll, or swag, with them during this period, and would record their progress and gather references from the masters they worked with. When this apprenticeship was completed, the craftsman could return to his home village and work there as a qualified tradesman. In Australia, those waltzing were more likely unskilled itinerant workers, such as farmhands or perhaps experienced jackaroos or skilled shearers, rather than anyone associated with a craft guild undergoing official training. But we can see enough similarity to understand why the term was adopted. It's likely the terminology arrived with the German immigrants, particularly during the 1850s gold rushes. The anglicised Matilda also has ancient, largely Northern European origins, the name meaning mighty battle maiden. O'Keefe goes even further, suggesting it was a term applied to female camp followers during various European wars, whom he suggests would sleep with the soldiers at night, keeping them warm, and thus the name was later used for the warm grey army coats the soldiers wore. An interesting origin story, perhaps. Though we assume any association of those terms with German was already lost by the approach of the 20th century. Otherwise, it doesn't seem likely that the diggers would have patriotically sung Waltzing Matilda in the trenches as they faced a German foe over no man's land, as it appears they did. In Australia, the name Matilda was used as another term for swag, or blanket that they carried for warmth, which they would use to wrap and carry their goods in when travelling. So here, if you were waltzing Matilda, you were travelling, carrying your Matilda or swag, with your tools and necessities of life rolled up in that blanket and tied across your shoulder, for comfortable tramping between one outback station or job and another. Australia's National Dictionary also adds, quote, "The term to waltz Matilda is first recorded in the late 1880s and is likely to have had a fairly short life if it hadn't been for the poet Banjo Paterson using it in 1895, unquote. So we'll talk more about that in a minute. Just to finish off the etymology of the term swag, though, the swag, as a bundle of goods carried by the swagman, was a term that was already known in Australia from the early convict times. Again, our National Dictionary reminds us, quote, "The Australian sense of swag is a transferred use of swag from the British thieves' slang, a thief's plunder or booty. Australians slightly altered the meaning from the booty itself to the booty and its container." And this language use was recorded by convict James Hardy Vaux in 1812 and published in his memoirs in 1819. James Hardy Vaux was a convict who compiled a dictionary of criminal slang that would help the snooty judges understand what an accused in his court may be talking about when relating his story in his own convict vernacular. And what a publication! I'll put a link to an online version of that slang dictionary in the reference list. It notes, quote, "Swag, a bundle, parcel or package, etc. The swag is a term used in speaking of any booty you have lately obtained, be it of what kind it may, except money, as, where did you lumber that swag? That is, where did you deposit the stolen property? To carry the swag is to be the bearer of the stolen goods to a place of safety. A swag of anything signifies, emphatically, a great deal. To have napped a good swag is to have got a good booty," unquote. This bloke deserves an episode all to himself one day, I think. Anyway, back to Waltzing Matilda for today. So now the chorus. "Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda, my darling? Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me? Waltzing Matilda and leading a water bag. Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me?" Not all versions include leading a water bag, but Macpherson's notes do, so it was in the original. It probably refers to using the often canvas water bag carried, holding the bag out in front, in lieu of a woman whom the swagman is leading in a dance or waltz. Sometimes the first line of the chorus is just "Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda," then "Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me?" And then the third line in the verse is used to repeat, "And he sang as he watched and waited till his billy boiled." Then maybe, "You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me." There's lots and lots of slight variants out there. So now, before we continue looking at the song itself, let's have a look at how and when it was written. The majority of credit goes to the famous Australian poet, best known as Banjo Paterson, though the music that inspired him to pen the words appears to have been provided by Christina Macpherson. Macpherson's papers are held in the National Library of Australia, and they include an undated letter that she wrote around 1934, describing exactly how Waltzing Matilda came about. Andrew Barton Paterson, or Barty as they called him, was born in 1864 near Orange in New South Wales. He lived his young life with his family on stations near Orange and later Yass, New South Wales, where he developed a deep love of the bush, station life, and horsemanship. His family had done pretty well on the land, and they moved in wealthy squatter and landholder circles. Patterson was sent off to Sydney Grammar School for his education, and he ended up becoming a solicitor in Sydney. Despite his city life in adulthood, he was still able to socialise with the more well-to-do station families, and his love of the bush life found another outlet in poetry. Along with Henry Lawson and many others, Patterson became a regular and very popular contributor to the Bulletin in the 1890s, at just about the height of its popularity and circulation as the Bushman's Bible, and he took on the pen name Banjo Patterson at that time. For a little more on his work, published in the Bulletin, and his relationship with Lawson, you can listen to episode 44, all about Henry Lawson. Patterson was probably best known for his poem The Man from Snowy River, though I've always personally preferred Clancy of the Overflow or the very humorous Man from Ironbark. In 1895, Patterson was on holiday in Queensland, and he and several companions were all staying at the Dagworth Station near Winton, pretty much in the centre of the state. He was accompanied by his fiancée of 8 years, Sarah Riley, and amongst the others at the Macpherson Station was Christina Macpherson and her brothers. At some point in the proceedings, Macpherson played, on her zither apparently, and you'll need to look that musical instrument up yourself, a jaunty little tune from memory, something she'd heard played, quote, by a band at the races in Warrnambool, a country town in the Western District of Victoria, unquote. When Patterson asked her the tune's name, she was unable to recall, but most sources suggest her rendition of what she heard was probably based on something called the Craigie Lee March. She wrote, quote, he then said he thought he could write some lines to it. He then and there wrote the first verse. We tried it, and we thought it went well, so he then wrote the other verses, unquote. Patterson seems to have used some local information that he had discovered and heard about during his stay to flesh out the storyline. Macpherson wrote, quote, there are always numbers of swagmen travelling about the country, some riding and some on foot, and they are usually given rations at the various stations that they come to, but in Queensland the distances are so great that they help themselves without asking. On this occasion, my brother and Patterson were out riding, and they came to a waterhole or billabong and found the skin of a newly killed sheep, all that was left by a swagman. And Patterson made use of this incident. Unquote. The pair apparently spent some hours fine-tuning the new song, and she noted, quote, I might add that in a short time everyone in the district was singing it. Unquote. So it looked already like it was going to be a hit, but apparently other occurrences may have soured the experience for her and Patterson. It's been suggested by some that Patterson may have been a bit of a pants man, or at least prone to sudden infatuations, because the salacious gossip suggests that while cozying up over the zither and the notepads, and while long-standing fiancée Sarah was somewhere nearby, Patterson and Macpherson were conducting some kind of affair, or a major flirtation at least, and it all blew up in a rather uncomfortable way. The engagement was abruptly called off, and that Patterson left the station in a hurry. Now, I've not gone into Patterson's biography in any detail or chased down this gossip any further, but I can say when Patterson did marry in 1903, it was neither to his previously long-standing fiancée Sarah nor to Christina Macpherson, so his original plans all went pear-shaped somehow. Macpherson's letter did add that, quote, after Mr. Patterson returned to Sydney, he wrote and asked me to send him the tune. I am no musician, but I did my best, and later on he told me he had sent it on to a musical friend of his who thought it would make a good bush song, unquote. And so it did, nearly a national anthem in time. Let's take a quick look at verse 2 then, and again I'm using the words from Macpherson's manuscript. Sometimes they're sung slightly differently. Down came a jumbuck to drink at that billabong. A jumbuck being a sheep, the term possibly coming from an Aboriginal pidgin English for sheep, from jump up. being a gambling sheep. Use of that term was recorded from the early 1800s. Up jumped the swagman and grabbed him with glee, and he said as he put him away into his tucker bag. Tucker is food, so a tucker bag is used to hold food. You'll come a-waltzing, Matilda, with me. So there Macpherson supplies us the explanation for the swaggy nabbing the sheep idea. But the question remains, what else prompted the later verses, and what is it actually about? So after stuffing that jumbuck in his tucker bag and the rendition of the chorus, the next verse begins, Up rode the squatter, mounted on his thoroughbred. The squatter was referring to the station owner. Squatters were men who simply took possession of land outside the government official settlement areas and grazed them, cleared or developed or perhaps fenced them, and simply squatted there, making money from their ventures. Over time, the government legitimised their holdings and many later cheaply leased and then gained title hold to the land that they'd begun illegally using. The Australian Dictionary further elaborates, quote, A squatter is a person who unlawfully occupies an uninhabited building, but in early 19th century Australia, a squatter, first recorded in 1825, was also a person who occupied Crown land without legal title. From the 1840s, it began to refer to any person who grazed livestock on a large scale without reference to the title by which the land was held, and the term squatter also referred to such a person as being of an elevated socio-economic status. Squatters became wealthy and powerful, and the term squatocracy, recorded in 1841, alludes to their aristocratic pretensions, unquote. So this squatter, confronting the swagman, has clearly done well for himself. He rides around his estates on a thoroughbred horse. No old bush nag for him. Down came the troopers, 1, 2, 3. So troopers are the police. Whose is that jumbuck you've got in your tucker bag? And I think the implication here is that it is the rightful property of the squatter and that the swagman has stolen it. You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. So while some think Waltzing Matilda to be simply a fun ditty with no real meaning, others feel that there is a much more interesting backstory that drew it into Patterson's consciousness. Macpherson already explained that Patterson's experience of finding the sheepskin at a billabong got him thinking about the swaggy, opportunistically stealing the sheep, and translating that experience into a song. But there had been a lot of other activity going on locally that Patterson would have heard about on his visit, and it seems very likely he drew on some of those tales as well. The 1890s were difficult times in Australia. There was a deep economic depression affecting all walks of life. In particular, wool prices were down and the station owners were looking to cut costs, particularly labour costs. Meanwhile, shearers and associated station labourers had for a long time been unhappy with their working conditions and pay. Many had banded together and joined unions, and by 1890, many sheds were in the throes of becoming union-only sites, causing some friction between those who supported unionism and those who did not, including the station owners. Many station owners were keen to break the union hold on such arrangements, and as the industry in general contracted and work became more scarce for the ordinary man, the environment was ripe for unhappy industrial action. Members of the Amalgamated Shearers Union of Australasia were soon pitted against those willing to work under individual agreements. The tension between the shearers, squatters and non-union workers grew, and as more worksites attempted to push the unions out, requesting their shearers sign individual contracts rather than work under union-mandated conditions, the unionised men felt they had to take a stand. Strike action was called, and the shearers made camps near various worksites intending to thwart the employment of non-union labour. The actions continued for many months and became so disruptive and antagonistic that it was considered Queensland was on the brink of a civil war. After the union shearers set up armed camps outside of towns in shearing districts, the government responded by sending armed soldiers in to protect the non-union labour and to arrest strike leaders. In some areas, the confrontation escalated to substantial violence, with unionists raiding shearing sheds, harassing non-union labour and committing acts of sabotage. But in the end, the shearers were unable to hold out. The strike was broken after some months, and the squatters had prevailed by mid-year, just as the shearing season began. But it was all a long way from being settled. Discontent and aggravation continued throughout the industry. As wool prices continued to fall and unemployment continued to rise, many shearers felt their poor conditions were receding even further. It came to a head once again in 1894, with a second mass strike, this time being enacted in New South Wales as well as Queensland. Once again, there was unrest, confrontation, sabotage, and some violence. In September of 1894, Dagworth Station, where Patterson and McPherson were to write Waltzing Matilda the following year, had been the site of some substantial unrest, and no doubt Patterson would have heard all about that during his stay. The Dagworth shearing shed had been the site of violent confrontation. The story retold as a group of striking shearers coming to the site, firing their rifles and pistols, and setting fire to the wool shed there, as they did to several others in the district too. Most of the sources are unclear about the exact timelines or details, but some suggest that Mr. McPherson and three policemen had given chase to those suspected of involvement at Dagworth, one in particular, a man named Samuel Hoffmeister, otherwise known as Frenchy, who was said to have been responsible for starting the fire. They didn't catch Hoffmeister, but the following day he was found dead, killed by a gunshot wound, at the 4 Mile billabong known as Combo Waterhole near Kayaknuna. After a judicial inquiry, his death was declared to have been suicide. So this is how verse 4 concludes the swaggy's story. But the swagman he up and he jumped into the waterhole, drowning himself by the coolabah tree. And his ghost may be heard as he sings in the billabong, who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me? Or, up jumped the swagman and sprang into the billabong, you'll never catch me alive, said he, and his ghost may be heard as you pass by that billabong, you'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. And then the chorus is sung one last time. While many who knew Hoffmeister and gave evidence at the inquiry indicated that he appeared to be quite the unstable fellow, perhaps we can see how his suicide might have been interpreted as him taking his life rather than being further pursued by the troopers 1, 2, 3 and taken prisoner. You'll never take me alive, said he. Indeed, there are a number of sources who like to imply that he might actually have been murdered, perhaps by the squatter or his companions. But certainly the story seems to have struck a chord with Patterson. In a radio interview in 1936, Banjo Patterson said, quote, the shearers staged a strike by way of expressing themselves, and McPherson's woolshed was burnt down, and a man was picked up dead, unquote. So it's clear he knew of the death, and there seems little doubt Hoffmeister's suicide was loosely translated into Patterson's swaggy jumping into the billabong rather than being taken by the troopers. Rather than just being an amusing little ode to a feisty swagman then, O'Keefe and others suggest its actual conception arises from some pretty awful incidents that occurred around Dagwood during the 1894 shearers' strike, and some which Patterson both heard about and witnessed himself while visiting in 1895. Patterson has made some alterations to the stories, but obviously some of the tales he heard had inspired the sad rather than jolly swagman's demise. The ABC quoted a Queensland history and politics professor concluding, quote, there seems to me no doubt that Waltzing Matilda wasn't just a little romantic ditty. It was a very deep, multifaceted political allegory and lament. It followed on directly from Banjo Patterson's first-hand account of what had happened in the 1894 shearers' strike in general and what had happened specifically at the Dagworth station, and he was aware of the suicide or murder of Frenchy Hoffmeister, unquote. The Australian Workers' Heritage Centre reminds us that, quote, Australia has only seen two armed insurrections between white settlers and government-backed forces, the Eureka Revolt of 1854 and the Queensland Shearer Strike of 1891, unquote. Just as the Eureka Stockade was a watershed for a developing democracy, so the Shearer Strikes, while perhaps not immediately successful in the sheds around the country, proved to be a defining moment for the labour movement in Australia. Henry Lawson wrote of the confrontations of the strike the poem Freedom on the Wallaby in May of 1891. We'll make the tyrants feel the sting of those that they would throttle. They needn't say the fault was ours if blood should stain the wattle. Although both major strikes in 1891 and 1894 failed in their objectives of having all shearers covered by a single award, with reasonable pay and conditions negotiated collectively, the movement and many of the men involved were instrumental in the formation and development of the Australian Labour Party, with its early manifesto declaring its party principles, calling for better working conditions, fair wages, and the recognition of workers' rights. So how did the little ditty, penned by the flirting pair in Winton, become the widely known pseudo-anthem of today? What really brought Waltzing Matilda to the tips of everyone's lips was that in 1903, the Billy T Company chose Patterson's Bush Song as their jingle, printing slightly modified words and sheet music to go with the tea packaging. A great marketing ploy, perhaps, with a certain symmetry of product, with swagmen boiling tea in their billies too, at a time when there was nostalgia for the bushman's way of life. The National Library of Australia wrote, quote, The Billy Tea Company used on its packet an image of a swagman, or swaggy, boiling his billy. Early in the 20th century, Billy Tea's owner, James Inglis, purchased the rights to the song Waltzing Matilda. Some of Banjo Patterson's original words of Waltzing Matilda were changed for an arrangement of the song, which was published in 1905 and was the earliest printed version of the song, unquote. They proposed to include a free copy of the newly arranged sheet music of Waltzing Matilda with every packet of tea sold. And it certainly created a level of cut-through, because long before it was ever recorded, it was reportedly sung by the Australian diggers in the Gallipoli trenches in World War I. O'Keefe chronicles Patterson hearing parading troops in Sydney singing his song and commented, quote, I only got a fiver for the song, but it's worth a million to me to hear it sung like this, unquote. Patterson may have been a little surprised, as I was myself, to note that when Australia held a poll in the 1970s to identify the preferred song to replace our national anthem, which was originally God Save the Queen and then Advance Australia Fair, Waltzing Matilda came in a very respectable second to the winner, Advance Australia Fair. Advance Australia Fair, while extremely old-fashioned and a little obscure, with its girt by sea and joyful strains, it does at least embody some very picturesque and uplifting lines to pull on the heartstrings of the patriotic and buoyant crowds that might gather to sing it. Honestly, apart from the fun in singing Waltzing Matilda, who could really be delighted at the image that the suicidal, thieving old jolly swagman encapsulates for our national pride? But it does hold a place in Aussie hearts, of course. Its lyrics have been micro-printed onto our passports in the past. Banjo's image and the words he wrote have graced not only the tea packaging, but our $10 note. Kids study the song in primary school. The National Film and Sound Archive notes that Waltzing Matilda was broadcast from space when the Space Shuttle Columbia astronauts played Slim Dusty's rendition as it passed over Australia on its maiden flight in 1981. The song has its own museum in Winton, and related memorials and monuments at numerous sites. Soldiers in World War II were still marching to the jaunty tune, and it's been sung at numerous sporting events, galas and official gatherings since it reached wide circulation in the early 20th century. So to date, it has shown great staying power. Not bad for a few hours at the zither with a notepad. You can't help but love Waltzing Matilda, can you? It's just too much fun. Okay, now let's see if I can create a musical mashup of a number of the versions I found to finish off today's episode. But before I go, I'd like to remind you about Denis O'Keefe's book on Waltzing Matilda, if you'd like a more detailed look. From the book bio of the late Denis O'Keefe, we learn that he was, quote, one of the nation's leading performers of Australian traditional songs and was a successful songwriting teacher for over 10 years. For many years, he led the Australian traditional song sessions at the National Folk Festival in Canberra. Denis played the Anglo concertina, an instrument that came to Australia during the gold rush of the 1850s. Denis was at the birth of hundreds of songs, having written some 40 songs about Australian history himself and nurtured many songwriters from their first idea through to their first public performances. O'Keefe was one of Australia's most respected music researchers, singers and writers. Now, I didn't get any recommendations from my listeners yet for new podcasts, and I don't have one of my own to give you this episode. Do send some through if you listen to some that you think we might enjoy. Anyway, thanks for listening. Take care, and I'll talk to you again soon. Cheers.
Jumped the swagman, and he grabbed him with glee.
He sang as he talked to that jump buck in his tucker bag. Come on, a twist in Matilda with me.
Waltzing Matilda, Matilda, my darling. You come a waltzing Matilda with me. And he sang as he jumped and jumped back in his tucker bag. You come a waltzing Matilda.
Up rode the squatter, mounted on his thoroughbred. Up rode the troopers, one, two, three. With the jolly jumbuck that you got in your tucker bag, you'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. With the jolly jumbuck that you got in your tucker bag, you'll come a waltzing.
Up jumped the swagman and sprang into the bar. You never catch me, and that said he. And his ghost may be heard as you pass by that billabong bar. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me.
Everybody!
A waltz. Matilda, Matilda, my darling, you'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda and lead in the water bag, you'll come a waltzing Matilda with me.
Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, who'll come a waltzing Matilda?